For the last 1500 years, Catholic theology has been shaped by the enduring influence of two intellectual giants, St. Augustine and St. Thomas Aquinas. Now, a third figure has appeared to present the faith of the Church in the language of our own age. Explore the dynamics of the teaching of Pope John Paul II on the program Faith for Today with Father Richard Hogan.
Hello, my name is Father Richard Hogan. I'm a priest of the Archdiocese of St. Paul in Minneapolis in Minnesota, and I work full-time with the permission of our Archbishop with Priests for Life, a national pro-life organization out of Staten Island, New York. But I'm here at EWTN Radio in order to continue the Faith for Today series, which is a presentation of the faith from A to Z, from God as one, all the way through other commandments and morality, according to the mindset of Pope John Paul II. This is the second in the series, and these first two programs, the last program and this one, explain the difference between John Paul II's approach to the faith and that of, say, St. Thomas Aquinas and St. Augustine. As we said in the first program, I was suggesting that there was a new synthesis of the faith promoted by Pope John Paul II. A synthesis of the faith means a union of a particular philosophical way of thinking and the reflection on revelation, which is called theology. Revelation is of course, what Christ revealed about God and man, and, of course, that affirmed and fulfilled the Old Testament revelation. And traditionally, the Church has always used philosophy as a handmaid to theology. Remember, theology is human reflection on revelation or doctrine and morals. There have been two great syntheses of the faith in the history of the West, St. Augustine, who used the philosophy of Plato, and St. Thomas Aquinas, who used the philosophy of Aristotle. Philosophy studies the existence of things in the world, and its highest study is the existence of man. And theology, obviously, is the study of revelation or the existence of God. But the two touch one another because created like God, obviously, the study of man is the study of God. The study of God, obviously, reveals something about man. So the two touch, and they've always been united. And Augustine, as I say, used the philosophy of Plato. Thomas Aquinas used the philosophy of Aristotle. Most of us, over 40 anyway, and perhaps down to 35 or so, learn the faith and the synthesis in the way that St. Thomas taught the faith, which was a union of revelation or theology and Aristotle. Now, the difficulty is that in modern times, we no longer think the way of St. Thomas of the 13th century. He thought very much in a principled, objective, and deductive way, and we think subjectively, experientially, and inductively. So the worlds don't meet, and for that reason, there was a necessity of updating the language of the faith, teaching it in a new way. Unfortunately, and this was recognized, John the 23rd, when he called the councils, I mentioned in the last show, asked for a new way of teaching the faith because there had to be a new language that was more appropriate for our own age. Unfortunately, after the Second Vatican Council, especially in catechetics, because the council granted the so-called permission, many in education throughout the old books, partly because it wasn't working very well anymore because kids didn't understand the language, and you had to teach a new language to the kids before you could teach the faith. I used the example last time of accident and substance. Most people today, when you say substance, think of drugs. Most people today, when you say accident, think of two cars bumping together by mistake. They don't think of accident as being something which exists in a substance, which may or may not be. They don't think of substance as that which exists in itself, which is the definitions used by St. Thomas. And so the terms no longer mean what they did in the 13th century, and therefore we need new terms that would convey the faith immediately rather than only after learning the definitions of the terms. And there's got to be a way to do this. There's got to be a way of teaching the faith experientially, inductively, and subjectively for our own age. And so there was a permission given kind of by the council, at least it was interpreted that way, to throw out the old books. And in doing so, of course, they unfortunately tried to marry the faith to the experiential, inductive, and subjective way of thinking. And because this is a challenge, I mean, it took a genius to create this new synthesis in the 13th century, St. Thomas. It took a genius to do it with Plato, which was St. Augustine. Most people were not capable of doing this, and so errors crept in. Errors crept into the catechetical texts. Errors because you made human experience the norm for the divine. For example, most chapters and most lessons on the Holy Eucharist would begin with the family meal, which made the family meal the norm for the Last Supper or for the Mass or the Eucharist, and it should be the other way around. Another error was a lack of system, because they threw out the old system. There was no linkage between the various subjects, and so people would not link one thing with another. And you had errors, as I discovered one time, when a group of students who had been in Catholic education for a number of years couldn't tell me that Jesus was God. The reason for this was because in the lesson on Christ, we taught them that Jesus was Son of God, absolutely scriptural, absolutely true. And in the lesson baptism, we taught them that they were children of God, absolutely true. And the students' minds work logically the way God created them to work. And so they say, well, I'm a child of God, which is true by baptism. And they say, Jesus is Son of God, which is the same as child of God, which is true too. And so they say, well, I'm not God, and neither is he. Now, it's logically correct, but they're missing a piece, and they're missing the piece because of the lack of system in the textbooks. It's very hard to develop a coherent system, and many, many people who are developing texts were not up to that. That's just to say that they're not geniuses like St. Thomas. This is not a criticism. It is simply a reality that most of us do not have that kind of intellectual power capable of doing something like that. So there were errors because of the emphasis on human experience. There were errors because of a lack of system. And there were also errors based on the idea that you don't teach certain things because people can't understand it. For example, I've heard people say you can't teach the Trinity to young children. But if you don't teach the Trinity to even preschool children, then they cannot understand that Jesus is God, because if there aren't three persons in one God, then the Jews were right. Jesus can't be God because there is only one, and God's in heaven. And since you're on earth, you're not God. That's absolutely true, unless there are three persons in one God, which, of course, is why it is essential to teach the Holy Trinity. Now, I don't mean teaching the 400 pages of St. Augustine's De Trinitate to preschool children. What I do mean is you teach the sign of the cross. So the attempt to marry the faith to the modern subjective, inductive, and experiential way of thinking caused problems in the catechetical world. And so in the 60s, 70s, even into the 80s, and we're living with it to a certain extent even now, one had the choice between a modern, pedagogically wonderful, from the modern point of view, series of textbooks, which, because of unintended problems, didn't teach the faith the way it should. Or one had the other choice was very rich doctrinal textbooks, but which taught the faith using the language of St. Thomas, which is just absolutely wonderful if you understand it. But you have to try to give these definitions to kids of terms which are not the most likely or the most logical or the most common definitions used today. So in effect, you're trying to teach the faith in a foreign language. And as I mentioned in the last program, enter John Paul II, because he united the faith with the reference in Genesis to the fact that we're created in God's image and likeness. Now that seems pretty logical. I mean, after all, it's the first book of the Bible, the first chapter of the first book of the Bible. What's so startling about that? What's so startling is that he made it a means of uniting the subjective, inductive, and experiential world with the objective, deductive, and principled world of the faith. Because created like God, created in his image and likeness, we're all individuals. We all have our own experiences. We all have our own subjective ideas and thoughts and experiences. So it's experiential, it's inductive, it's subjective, because we're all special orders. And yet, it has the tie to the ultimate objective truth, God himself. This opens the door to the modern world. It opens the door particularly with John Paul II to his philosophy, which was phenomenological or phenomenology, the study of phenomena. So this is a new synthesis of phenomenology, which is a modern philosophical movement begun in Germany by Edwin Husserl around the turn of the last century, around 1900, unites phenomenology with revelation or theology, unites the subjective, inductive, experiential world with the deductive, principled, and objective world of the faith. This is a completely new synthesis, and everywhere he goes, he promotes this. You know, how else do you explain the volume of materials that he has written? He has to have a system that is coherent and that he can just spin out. If he had to create every idea he spoke, it would take him months to write a talk, especially the kind of talks that he gives, or months to write an encyclical, which are, in his pontificate, book length. No, there's a system in place. There's a new synthesis. It's the third great synthesis of the faith in the West. The first was Augustine, who used Plato. The second is Thomas, who used Aristotle. And the third is John Paul II, who is using phenomenology. This opens the door, if you will, to a modern presentation of the faith using modern language without doing violence to the faith. Let me give you some examples. The commandments. Now, if you say to people today, the commandments are rules or guidelines, they feel that this is an external imposition on them. One says, you should do this. And the answer is, well, I don't have to do that. I'm free. I can do what I want. But if you say the commandments are the way God acts and the way an image of God should act, you don't have to do this. You have free will. You can do whatever you want. But these commandments tell you who you are and how you should act, because they tell you who God is and how God acts, and you're created like God. The line is, don't be dumb. Don't do something stupid. Act in the way you're made. You can not act in the way you're made. You have free choice, free will. You can do whatever you want. But if you do not act in the way you're made, you end up hurting yourself. Don't do this. It also unites creation and the incarnation, because we're created like God in creation. And Christ is absolutely essential to us, because unless we know who God is and how God acts, we don't know who we are and how we should act, because we're created like God. So Christ reveals man to man himself, as the Vatican Council taught in paragraph 22 of the Pastoral Constitution on the Church in the Modern World. Created like God, we need to know God to know ourselves. We need to know how God acts to know ourselves, and Christ shows us who God is and shows us how God acts. So Christ is essential for every single human being. And this makes sense out of many things the Pope writes. For example, the way of the Church is man. He says that over and over again. That's in his first encyclical. What does that mean? Well, obviously, if the Church is the continuation of Christ through space and time, the Church is the mystical Christ. And one of Christ's missions was to show us who God is and show us how God acts. Then, because this is essential to human beings, because without it, we don't even know what it is to be a human being or what it is to act like a human being, then the Church continues that mission. And the most important reality for the Church is the human person. And so the way of the Church, that is to say, the purpose of the Church, or the reason why the Church exists, or what the Church considers critical, is the human person, because the Church exists to reveal who God is and how God acts, just like Christ did, to the individual human person. In assuming human nature and not absorbing it, he raised human nature to be worthy of the divine, says John Paul, I'm paraphrasing, in his first encyclical. In assuming human nature and not absorbing it, we became worthy of the divine, because he assumed our human nature. Each and every single one of us are worthy of being united with God himself, because he united human nature with the divinity, with the second person of the Trinity. These are just some examples of the fruit of this new synthesis. Now realize what I'm saying here. What I'm trying to defend is that John Paul II has developed a third synthesis of the faith, a union of philosophy and theology. That this third synthesis unites phenomenology, this philosophical movement from Germany around the turn of the century, with the faith. That this is the equivalent of Thomas uniting revelation and theology with Aristotelian thought, and equivalent of Augustine uniting revelation or theology with the philosophy of Plato. And if this is even possible, let alone true, let's just say it's arguable, then we're living in incredibly interesting times, because this hasn't happened for 800 years. And obviously, the writings and speeches and talks of Pope John Paul II are going to be with us for centuries. Maybe not 8 centuries, maybe not 6, but certainly 3 or 4. The last two lasted about 8 centuries each, 700 to 800 years each. 430, the death of Augustine, until, let's just say, 1230. Actually, St. Thomas didn't die until the 1270s. That's 800 years, and 1270 to 1970 is 700 years. So we're living in incredibly interesting times. So the thesis is that John Paul II has developed a new synthesis of the faith, a union of philosophy and theology based on phenomenology, that this yields a new language, and that this new language is a way of explaining the faith today that uses the language of today, uses the modern way of thinking, without doing violence to the faith, and that this will be the way that the Church will teach the faith for hundreds of years. Now, is there any evidence of all this other than the writings of John Paul? Well, I'd like to go through some interesting incidences of his life, particularly his election as Pope, which indicate, I think, that something's going on here. Now, no one of these alone proves anything, but all of them together at least indicate, I think, the activity of the Holy Spirit in the Church in an extraordinary way, and at least the possibility that this really is interesting times, that he really is doing something that we need to pay attention to, and that it just possibly might be this new synthesis of the faith. I'm Father Richard Hogan, Associate Director of Priests for Life, a national organization promoting the gospel of life with regards to abortion and euthanasia. We're located on Staten Island, New York, 10314, P.O. Box 141172. Call us at 718-980-4400. Or contact us at our website, www.priestforlife.org. What are the indications that John Paul is a very, very significant pope in the history of the Church? Well, I want to take you back to 1978 when he was elected. The first thing is the two popes of 78 were not expected to be chosen. Now, this is very unusual in the 20th century, even in the 19th for that matter. Usually, with the election of Pope, people have a pretty good idea of who the next Pope might be. In fact, there are so-called papabili lists, and cardinals who are, quote, able to be Pope. That's what papabili means. And normally there's one or two or three people on it. But in 1978, there was a very long list. Nobody really knew who the cardinals might elect. And yet, despite the length, in the first election of 1978, someone not on the so-called list. Now, remember, this list is not a formal list. This list is put together by other cardinals, by media people, by people who watch the Church. So it's not anything official. It's just a list of who people think might be elected as Pope. Normally, this is, as I say, has been in the 20th century anyway, short, 2, 3, 4 people. But in 1978, it was incredibly long. And despite the length, someone who was not on the list was chosen. Cardinal Luciani, John Paul I. And in fact, Cardinal Felici, the Dean of the College of Cardinals, at the time of the election, came out on the balcony and said to the world, Habemus Papam, we have a Pope, Nomen Episcopi Cardinali, Sancti Romani Ecclesiae, the name of the Cardinal Bishop of the Roman Catholic Church who has been elected is Luciani. And the whole world went, who? Because nobody knew who this guy was. He turned out to be the Patriarch of Venice, and he took the name John Paul I. I remember I was watching one of the major news networks, and the anchor said, well, just wait a minute now. You know, this, we had this list, and we had dossiers on all of these popes, and yet, or all these possible popes, and this guy wasn't on the list. So we're going to have to work a little bit, and in about a half hour we'll get some information on this fellow, and they work frantically in the back room looking for baby pictures and whatever else they could come up with. But obviously they weren't prepared for this election. Well, of course, then everybody knows John Paul I died after only about 3 weeks in office, and there was another whole election. The cardinals all went to Rome. They had the mass for the deceased pope, the mass for to the Holy Spirit for inspiration for the election of a new one. And this time, of course, the newscaster said, we got the waterfront covered. We did all Italians. We got every last Italian cardinal. Plus, we got all of these people from around the world who might be elected. We're not going to get caught flat-footed this time. Okay? So after, I think it was 4 votes, Felici again comes out of the balcony and says, Habemus Papam, Nomen Episcopi Cardinali, Sancti Romani Ecclesiae, Votiva. And the anchor that I was watching just about fainted on the screen because they didn't have a dossier in Votiva. Nobody expected him to be chosen. Now, this is incredible because, especially with the second election, they had almost everybody. You know, it's almost the Holy Spirit saying, you know, this is my business and not yours. But one thinks of the saying, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. But they got the... They got someone who was not expected to be chosen, and what a pope he's been. This is very extraordinary, very unusual. First of all, 2 popes chosen who were not on anyone's list anywhere. Now, the second extraordinary thing, now remember the first is that were the 2 popes of 78 were not expected to be chosen. The second is the double name. Now, we've gotten used to this, but there hasn't been a change in the way the popes have taken their names since the 970s. I think there have been 2 popes who kept their baptismal names since then. But other than that, there's been no change. And you have to understand how extraordinary it is for a pope to change anything. This is steeped in tradition. You know, they still crack the ring of the pope. And the reason, after he dies, the reason is because that was used to authenticate letters with the seal. They would send a letter, and when they closed the envelope, they would dump some wax from the candle on their desk onto the flap of the envelope, closing it and sealing it. And then in the hot wax, they would impress the ring. And since that was a unique ring that only the Pope had, that authenticated the letter. Well, of course, they don't authenticate letters that way anymore. They do it with protocol numbers and all kinds of other things. And we don't need to worry about that so much today, at least not in that way. And yet, because they always crack the ring, they still crack the ring. They also do what a friend of mine calls the papal death tap. And when the Pope is apparently dead, one of the cardinals comes up and takes a silver or gold hammer reserved for the occasion, taps him on the forehead 3 times, calling out his baptismal name. So for Pope Paul VI, it was Giovanni Montini. And so they tap him on the forehead with this silver hammer and say, Giovanni, and second time, Giovanni. 3rd time, Giovanni, and if he didn't answer the 3rd time, he must be dead. Now, of course, they know he's dead. The doctors have certified it. There's no question that he died. But they still say that he died only after the 3rd call with the hammer, because that's the way they always did it. So to change something here, it was incredible. When John Paul I, Luciani, was elected, and he decided to take the name John Paul I, one of the cardinals must have gone up to him and said, you can't do that. And he must have said something like, oh, yes, I can. I'm the Pope. And he did it, which is an extraordinary change in the history of the church. Unbelievable. The third thing is the obvious one, the 2 papal elections in a single year. You know, the question was in 78, did the Holy Spirit get the wrong one the first time? This hasn't happened since 1605. So 2 elections in 1 year hasn't happened in over 350 years. Very, very extraordinary. Very unusual. The 4th thing was the non-Italian pope. I mean, he's from Poland. There hasn't been a non-Italian pope since Adrian VI in 1523. That's 450-some years. Not only is he not Italian, he's from a communist country. Of course, the famous movie The Shoes of the Fisherman sort of predicted the election of a non-Italian, a communist prelate, a communist cardinal. But remember that movie, the new pope, the Russian cardinal who was elected pope, made peace with the communist world, sold the Vatican treasures to feed the hungry Chinese and settle the potential war between or among America, the Soviet Union, and communist China. But that's not the thrust of this pontificate. The thrust of this pontificate is clear, especially clear now, with the falling of the Berlin Wall and the fall of the communist governments. Clearly, this is not a pope who was making peace, but rather was promoting the gospel and seeing to it that atheistic communism, as far as he was able to, atheistic communism would no longer rule the world. So it doesn't come out quite the way The Shoes of the Fisherman did. Now, those are the first four. So just to review, the two popes of 78, the double name, the two papal elections single year, the non-Italian pope. Now, after his election, the volume of material he has written is absolutely incredible. It just is immense. A scholar working at a university desk with a staff the size of, you know, a whole classroom couldn't produce this kind of material. It clearly is, especially with the other burdens of the office. The travels. You remember that from 1871 to 1929, the Pope never left Rome, never left the Vatican. And even in modern times, Paul VI had a very limited travel. Jerusalem and the UN, and I think he went to Istanbul, Constantinople one time, but very, very limited. He's not traveling all over the world. This man logs miles and miles of airline travel. His popularity, despite what he's saying many times, don't do this and you can't do that, and we can't be materialistic. We can't be so involved in sexuality and so on. And yet, JP2, we love you. Now, that's died off a little bit lately, but it's still there. The assassination attempt. There has not been an assassination attempt on a pope by a government, and this clearly had some governmental overtones, since the attack on Boniface VIII in the 14th century, 1302. It's extraordinary. And finally, number nine, we have a theologian pope. And again, that hasn't happened since the Middle Ages. So we have the two popes of 78, number one, the double name, the two papal elections in a single year, the non-Italian pope, the volume of stuff he's written, his travels, his popularity, the assassination attempt, and a theologian pope. I think the Holy Spirit is trying to say, look at this guy, see what's here, and just possibly it's what I've been suggesting, that there's a new synthesis of the faith, a union of phenomenology and theology, which will be the way the church teaches the faith for centuries to come. I'm Father Richard Hogan, Associate National Director of Priests for Life. I would love to visit your community. Contact us at Staten Island, New York, 10314, Post Office Box 141172. Thank you very much for listening.
Join us again next time for Faith for Today with Father Richard Hogan here on EWTN Global Catholic Radio.